Welcome to Strictly Business, Variety's weekly podcast featuring conversations with industry leaders about the business of media and entertainment. I'm Cynthia Littleton, co-editor-in-chief of Variety. Today, my two guests offer perspective on aspects of the broadcasting business that we haven't covered closely on this podcast. Paula Kerger, president of PBS, discusses the mission of public broadcasting and why it still matters in a world awash in content. Neil Saban, vice chairman of Chicago-based Weigel Broadcasting, explains how a family-run company with a handful of stations wound up being a pioneer in the multicast network arena. With channels like MeTV, Weigel has proven that reruns of Bonanza and Perry Mason can still pack them in. Welcome back to Strictly Business.
Paula Kerger, president and CEO of PBS. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for being with me.
Paula, you've been the head of PBS for going on 15 years now, and I can imagine that that's never been a cushy gig. PBS is always in terms of its funding and the support that it receives from the federal government and from the public. There have been, you know, many ups and downs. I'm sure you knew going into the job that was going to be part of it. I also have to believe that the last 12 months or so have been probably among some of the most challenging that you've faced in running the nation's non-commercial public broadcasting network. Let me just start by asking you, how has PBS at the national level, and what are you seeing from the grassroots of the affiliates, how has PBS fared in the COVID crisis?
Yeah, look, a lot has changed in the 15 years that I've been in this job, you know, as you look across the media landscape. But this last year has been extraordinary. I guess that's the best way to describe it. And everyone I think you talk to would probably say the same thing. But in a very odd way, I feel like this has been probably the most important year for PBS. And that's because I think so much of what we've been able to do this last year has been built on what has been a 50-year history of work that we've done across the country. So this past year, we had actually planned to celebrate our 50th anniversary. We were going to do the usual things one does, pull out old clips of people that have appeared on public television. We were signed on by Julia Child, so we had great clips and so forth. But I think that, you know, it started actually pretty fast. So last February, I got a call from Austin Buettner, who, you know, the superintendent of LA Unified, and they actually have a public television station, and he was anticipating that kids were going to be home, and he was particularly worried about kids that weren't going to have access to broadband. And he wondered if there was anything that we could do to help. They have a station with just a few employees. And so we got our LA station engaged, and some mm-hmm. of our other stations came together. And we run a service called Learning Media, which is a broadband service that delivers K-12 content directly to computers. And we looked at how we could build something for broadcast as well as amping up the service we provided through broadband. And we were off and running. You know, actually, the LA model was then copied around the country. I think almost every state now has picked up some version of that. We were reaching about 1 million teachers a month before COVID, and we went up, I think initially went up to like 3 or 4 million, and now it's stabilized. It's about 3 million users a month. So I think the educational work has been significant. And because we have relationships in school systems across the country, remember, we started as education television. It was, there was that. Obviously the news, this has been an important news year. And people, I think, have hungered to look for places where they could find information they could trust. And so, Judy Woodruff started doing the news out of her house and in front of that beautiful case, as others did. And we had an amazing team, Michelle Cinder at the White House, and Amna Nawaz and Lisa Desjardins, who did amazing reporting on January 6th. So there was that. And then—
Can I ask you, Paula, about on the education initiative, was that something that cost you resources? Was that something that you had to put funding into to make happen, or were you able to do it with existing infrastructure?
we had a lot of the infrastructure already built. So my point of being sort of ready, we didn't have to suddenly create a whole new business. We had it. And so, you know, we did spend some additional money to, you know, embellish the work that we already had underway, but we had a lot of it already done. And so that, has ended up being, you know, I think tremendously important across the country. And then, you know, obviously in the news space, we also have invested a little bit more in some of that news coverage because there was just so much that was happening, and just being able to pivot from working out of a studio to working in all these remote locations and so forth. And then, you know, the other thing is we thought a lot about, you know, people at home and what are people looking for? They're looking to be entertained. They're looking to be reminded of perhaps aspects of our better selves. We brought some of Ken Burns' work back, beginning with baseball when they delayed last year's baseball season. We rolled out a lot of Broadway and theater and other stuff. And then George Floyd was murdered. And so we then quickly pivoted, and there, our work over, frankly, decades really came to the fore because we had a lot of content that we had produced around race in America that we were able to bring forward, including Skip Gates' recent project on Reconstruction. So, you know, so I feel like every step of the way we've moved. But look, we made a lot of stuff up on the fly. We went from an organization that worked in a largely office space to largely working remote. Even some of our technical crew who keep the entire interconnection going for the whole country, some of those staff members also started working remotely. So it wasn't just the content that we continued to explore, you know, new opportunities, but we also looked very hard at the technology itself and how we would be able to support it working at a distance.
How have the events and all this activity and people, you know, spending more time with PBS and really recognizing, has that translated into a boost in fundraising at the either institutional level or at the individual donor level?
I'll particularly comment on, you know, because you asked me a few minutes ago about our stations, which I realize I didn't fully answer. And so I can tell you a bit about, you know, I described what happened in LA, and obviously that's through our local stations, and then we helped to enable that work across the country. But I think for our stations, being able to benefit from the fact that people were watching a lot of PBS over the course of this last year. So many of them actually have seen an increase in the number of people who've become members of their stations. Corporate money, sponsorship money has been harder. And for any station that has been raising money around events and so forth, that also has been harder. So I would say it's a little bit of a mixed story. But a year ago, I was really prepared that things were just going to go off the cliff, and that because I mean, who knew where all of this was heading? And we were very much focused on a few things: is just making sure that we were delivering all the core activities that stations really needed. We obviously were looking very carefully at our pipeline, and we do work well in advance. So we were in a different position than some of the networks who got caught scrambling a bit to fill broadcasts.
Right.
Well, we had a pretty rich pipeline. It's not to say we weren't impacted, and we were. And some of our programs, like Call the Midwife, which is a drama presentation, has gotten pushed out.
Right.
And its roadshow did not tape this past year because they couldn't. And so,
right.
There are definitely series that have been impacted, but I think for the most part, we've had a pretty strong season of fresh content. And the stations, I think part of it is because of all the education work they were doing, part of it because people were watching, and we had really strong content. Knock on wood, it's been a reasonably good year, not for all stations. Some really have had a deeper impact. Some areas that were affected deeper than others clearly have. But I think for the most part, you know, sort of fingers crossed. We've never been awash in funding at public broadcast.
Right.
So I don't want anyone to think the dollar's just pouring right in.
Right,
But it's very different than I thought was going to be the case, that we were going to look at stations who were going to face existential crises moving forward. I think we're in a reasonably good place now, but obviously are going to be looking carefully at as we look ahead.
What is your total affiliate base right now? Is it about 200 stations or so?
No, we have 335 stations. So it's a lot. It's a lot. And, you know, they serve everything from, you know, New York City to Bemidji, Minnesota. And by the way, the Bemidji station actually does a light nightly newscast. So it's...
I bet they have a big share.
They do, actually. They have a very big share. And it's... And I haven't visited every station, but I've visited most. I've been right before the lockdown, I visited my 50th state. And, it's amazing when you see some of these operations. You know, I point to the NewsHour. I mean, the coverage they were able to do with a very small staff is truly extraordinary. But it's so I always say we punch well above our weight.
Let me ask you, has it, you know, at a time of you know, incredible growth of programming platforms and competition for content, costs rising, has that programming pipeline that PBS has always been so good at planning and planning far out with co-productions and things, you know, coming from all sorts of sources, not just in the US, but is that programming pipeline squeezed now because there is so much demand for global content?
There, in some areas it is tougher. Drama is tougher. But we seem to find drama that, that people really love. And, you know, All Creatures Great and Small this winter, which turned out to be, I watched it like a regular viewer. I watched it on Sundays and it just carried me through the long, dark winter. And it was cold in here, unlike LA, I know. Maybe it wouldn't have had the same significance for you. But
you're in Virginia?
Yeah, I'm in Virginia. So yeah, it was cold winter. We had a lot of snow. And so all Creatures Great and Small. But so I think I would say that the drama pipeline was a little harder and it created opportunities. So we had a couple things fall out. We just picked up a series called Atlantic Crossing, which actually started running last week and has done well, actually. It's an unknown, untold story of a World War II story with Churchill. And, so I think that there is complications there. I think in the documentary space, it's interesting because, you know, I read article after article about this is really the golden age of documentaries. In many ways, it's true. Mm-hmm. A lot of great documentaries. We all watched the record number of documentaries that were submitted for Oscar consideration this year. And a lot of streamers in particular are picking up documentary, but a lot of them, you know, are now moving towards more, you know, sort of the programming that drives off of current events like the HBO series on QAnon to to crime and so forth. Mm-hmm. And so, again, we kind of sit by ourselves over here. So, you know, I'm just really interested in looking at ways that, you know, we can continue to expand stories, particularly stories that aren't often told or often well told, because ultimately I don't have to adhere to the same pressures that a commercial organization will in terms of audience size. I can take a little bit more risk and bring stories forward that, you know, are just important stories. So I would say that for us the interesting question is all the platforms and which ones we should pursue. We did a deal last year with YouTube TV, which has turned out to be good. Brand matters. And so, and as you said a little while ago, people understand the PBS brand, they understand what it means. And a lot of our stations have more aggressively adopted either the PBS logo or the PBS name as part of their station itself. And so I think that that is all, you know, really redounds to the good, particularly as you're looking at distributing on multiple platforms, broadcast, obviously cable satellite, but also digital streamed, places like YouTube. It's a constant question for us of where are our viewers, where would they expect to see our content? How do we put it there? But more importantly, how do we put our stations there with content branded for them, so that it's clear that not only are you getting great work by Ken Burns, but if there's companion pieces that the stations have also produced, it's all there you know, for you to see and appreciate.
Do you get any, have you seen any benefit in terms of the rise of the digital MVPDs, the YouTube TVs, the Rokus, the Hulu Live? Do you get any kind of fees for carriage when you're on those platforms? I know in the traditional world, it's often governed by what is known by the wonky term of must carry in FCC parlance, and you get carriage but not fees. Is that the same in the digital world?
We get carriage and not fees. We have on some of the partners have helped us defray some of our costs of getting our stuff up, but we're really it's not a revenue stream for us in the same way that it would be, you know, for a commercial organization. And we're also careful around the advertising part for, you know, some of the streamers that are ad supported. Although we have started experimenting with some older content just as a way to push our material out. We have rights for some older content and not for others. And I'm just really interested in trying to hit people wherever they may be watching to just remind them of all the great content within PBS. Like everyone else, I don't think anyone's really figured this out. I think everyone is just trying a lot of different opportunities. And that's certainly what we're doing. And I'm grateful to our stations because, at the beginning of this really interesting media period that we're in, you know, I know that there were some that were very nervous about, you know, moving beyond a realm that they completely controlled, which is what you had when you had a broadcast stick.
Right.
But, you know, the stations really understand that for us to be in multiple places and to have our brand out there, if we're purposeful about it and try to connect the dots back, everyone benefits. So we've been spending a lot of time thinking through all of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As you know, as I think I said in the beginning, it's the leading this organization is never been a cushy job and probably never been more challenging than it has been in the last bunch of months. Paula, what would you say in your background? You've been CEO of PBS now for 15 years. What would you say in your background, your work experience or your life experience that best prepared you for the challenges that you have now as CEO?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think I'm going to answer it in a funny way. I think in some ways, some of the things that best prepared me to manage this organization have been, frankly, working for people who weren't such great managers, because you do learn more. I mean, I've had great mentors, so I don't mean to sound so flip about it. And I've had people that I've continued to talk to over the years, because we all keep running up against things we've never experienced before. Lord knows this year has been filled with those experiences. But I think that, you know, clear communication, frequent communication, which has certainly been important this year, is being able to listen well, but to make decisions and move. These are all aspects of leadership that I've not always found in people that I've worked for, and I know the impact that it had on me. And so I think that, you know, that's prepared me pretty well. I guess the other thing is, you know, just on a personal basis, I'm interested in a lot of things. I started out in college in pre-med, because I was always interested in science. I failed organic chemistry. I took a lot of liberal arts classes, panicked I'd never graduate, got a degree in business. But I always carried forward all these different interests. And I think that also is, I think in a funny way, that's helped me, because I just have a lot of curiosity about a lot of things. So I know to ask a lot of questions. I also understand the scientific method. And I know that you can actually land decisions and without full information. And so I think all of those things actually, you know, came to the fore when I hit this job. It's interesting. You've mentioned it now twice about when I, you know, this has never been an easy job. I remember when I was doing the first round of interviews, when it was first announced that I had been appointed to this job, that somebody I interviewed with, and it was a radio interview, I just can't remember who it was, it's like sort of likened it to walking into the gates of hell, which I thought was so bizarre. So funny. And I said, well, I'm not exactly sure that's what, you know, will feel like, but anyway, I appreciate the question. But what I, have thought about, actually, as I have, have been in this job, is that my first speech I gave was right around the time that Apple announced they were going to sell episodes of Desperate Housewives for $1.99.
Right. That was a groundbreaking thing.
And it just sounded so weird. Like, who would spend $1.99 on an episode of Desperate Housewives?
To watch on a tiny screen.
Watch on a little screen, right? But it was the signal of how everything was going to change. And I think that, if you just look at the arc of everything, I mean, someone gave me a Netflix subscription as I was moving from New York to Washington, and it was the DVDs. So just in the arc of time that I've been in this job, it's the entire world has shifted. And I think that, for me, the other thing sort of in life experience is you got to be willing to take risk and know that, even if you can't ultimately predict what the outcome is going to be, that you're going to go on some path. And, chances are you won't get killed in the process and that you're going to learn something. This is what we learned from all the digital people, right? Is that the internet way of iteration rather than building perfection, and which is the, I think, the biggest sea change in our business, is that, you just have to keep, trying different things, but you can't be afraid. And I think that's the other, I think, really important theme in everything that we've tried to do is just let's take some risk. It's very hard for nonprofits to do that, by the way,
right?
Because you're always worried that, someone's going to accuse you of wasting their money. But organizations don't grow unless you fail some of the time. Mm-hmm. And I think most people understand that.
Do you have a wish list or anything on your wish list for PBS or for your cousin, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, from the new Biden administration?
Oh yeah. I mean, I think the thing that for me is very exciting is that we have a teacher in the White House, and Jill Biden has been a big proponent of public broadcasting, and I think that, again, if you understand that we're built on this idea of educational television, that was the original concept, a lot of what we do still ties into that. And so to have someone that is passionate about education is hugely important. So, we're a public-private partnership. That's what LBJ envisioned when he created PBS. And so to have a White House that really understands what that means, and I'm optimistic that, we're on a stronger path right now.
We'll take a short break now and be back with Weigel Broadcasting's Neil Saban. And we're back with Weigel Broadcasting's Neil Saban. Neil has shepherded the growth of multicast networks that are now competing for ad dollars and eyeballs in the big leagues of broadcast TV.
Neil, I'd love to start by asking you, more than a decade ago, what was it about the opportunity that you saw? What was it that made Weigel such a pioneer in this space?
I think part of that is that Weigel is a family-owned entrepreneurial company that can move very quickly on ideas, whether those ideas are technology-based or programming, content-based. We don't have a lot of people involved in the decision-making process, so we can move quickly. And we are, a business that looks for ways where we can exploit opportunities. Being small, we can't do a lot of the things that bigger companies can do when they have the massive scale of, covering 70% of the country, 60% of the country. But what we can do is look for areas of expansion that maybe those people haven't looked at yet, which is why I think we were one of the first to jump on this sub-channel bandwidth opportunity. The chairman, president of our company, Norm Shapiro, came into my office one day, and I could still see him sitting on my couch saying, "Neil, what would you do if you had 5 television stations here in Chicago? How would you program them?" And he explained to me what the digital transition was going to mean for television stations. And I think, to also answer your question, Cynthia, it is that in Chicago, we had more than one station. We have a very powerful low power that is the transmitter and antenna are on top of Sears Tower along with our main channel in Chicago and covers the market beautifully. And we were doing at one point ethnic programming on that second channel and then started MeTV on that second channel as a Chicago only entity. And it was doing well. So we were already kind of in the multicast business before multicast came along.
Right.
And then when the technology allowed us to put both of those signals on one channel, it was kind of a natural. And the first thing we really wanted to do was MeTV, a classic TV channel. But many of the distributors, when I went to see them, they were not enthusiastic because they didn't really understand what this was. And some of the initial first people into the business, I think were not really professional broadcasters or people that had track records and credibility. So it took us a while, and I went to see all the syndicators, and it took place at ANAPTE. And I finally had a meeting with John, JB, John Bryan at MGM, and said, hey, I want to buy some of your classic shows to do this. And he said, you know, Neil, everybody is coming to me talking about this. Why don't we just do it ourselves? And he was an entrepreneurial kind of guy too.
Right. Like us.
And it's literally in that meeting at ANAPTE when he said, why don't we do this ourselves? That's how this TV was formed, which was the first one, because MGM doesn't have a big classic TV show library. They have movie library.
Right.
So this TV was the first major, majorly distributed Diginet to come out. And it was mostly movies because that's what MGM had. But by doing that, it gave our company some more comfort and experience in making the huge financial commitment that MeTV was.
Yeah.
Because I will tell you that when we started MeTV, we did it that in a way we said we were always going to be very credible. And what we actually did, and Norm Shapiro likes to say we really threw the dice on this one, we went and acquired all the programming on a national basis to start MeTV, with the only affiliates being our own stations.
Can you talk about the pacing of like the growth of these as businesses, as the growth of viewership, the growth of advertising dollars? Was it fast? Was it an uphill climb?
Well, for us, it was pretty rapid in that it started with direct response advertising, which is still
as so many core things do in TV.
Yes. Right. And it's still a big core, and more advertisers are using DR, as it's called, or hybrid DR, which needs ratings. And, you know, you can't even tell when you see the commercials that it's really bought as DR because it looks like regular spot advertising, but they are buying it on a kind of a DR hybrid basis where you've got to have some ratings for them to be able to track it. But it was almost like they were looking for a place to go. And it was very opportunistic for the advertisers and for us. I mean, we were welcomed. In part, the advertisers used us, I'm sure, as leverage with the cable networks and syndication to say, look, I can get this for a lot less money than that. And our rates of, you know, they've gone up substantially, obviously. MeTV and our other networks, you know, are quite successful. And you see all these other companies, like you mentioned, Cynthia, the big boys, getting into this business. And they don't get into businesses that they think aren't going to grow or aren't going to be successful. And what's happened of late, and what was especially for MeTV, which has significant ratings, is that as cable and broadcast ratings have come down, the need to buy impressions and to get down what the agencies need to get down in terms of audience reach has gotten to the point where they need networks like MeTV to make their campaign successful because they can't get all of those rating points and impressions on cable anymore.
It really is a patchwork quilt these days.
Yeah, and of everything.
And again, so interesting because if you look just on the surface, you would think, you know, all the projections for digital advertising, you know, double, a high single digit, double digits going out into the future. You would think in that environment, it'd be really hard to start a TV channel, a linear, essentially, I won't say analog, but a linear channel that is, you know, ad supported and is, you know, inevitably going to start small and have to grow a viewer base. You would think in that environment that there wouldn't be leftover advertising dollars for diginets, but I think that it just underscores the power of TV, that you can, when you turn on your set, you can basically find it, that the power of that is still pretty strong.
It is not a science project to watch on TV. You do not need a password to watch me. You do not get a bill to watch me TV. And as you say, you know, people a lot smarter than me are starting diginets left and right. So there must be something there that their analysts and their stock people are saying that they should be doing this. So, it's, and you know, sometimes we all get caught up in the, I call it the emperor's new clothes syndrome. We have to get on the bandwagon of 3.0 and we have to get on the bandwagon of streaming services and all that, because that's what everybody's doing. But, you know, Ma and Pa, whoever in Dayton, Ohio, they're still watching traditional TV for most of the time that they're spending with their media. So there's a business there, and it may not be the sexiest, newest thing, but it works.
And MeTV is not, it is not available for streaming, or it is?
Not now. No, it's not streamed. In the future, that could happen. But right now, our ratings, our success, our business comes all off of traditional viewing.
Does the, you know, I guess it's hard. It's a little bit apples and oranges in terms of MeTV's national rating versus, like, you know, the ratings for your broadcast stations in Chicago or Milwaukee. Is it, I mean, is MeTV, is it getting that competitive to being like competitive with something distributed by a full-blown, you know, broadcast?
Well, in Milwaukee, our MeTV affiliate beats our independent, the CW, the MyNet, and some days ION every day in sign on to sign off numbers. I mean, MeTV has about 26 million viewers a week, different viewers a week. We cum about 26 million. In daytime, if you compare us against all cable networks from 9A to, I think it is 6P in all viewers, you know, 2+ viewers, we're the number one entertainment choice. We beat every cable network but the newscasts, the news networks.
What are your workhorse shows right now? I know you change up the lineup, but right now, what are your workhorses?
Yeah, some of our Facebook critics want us to change up things a whole lot more, but you know, you don't fix what isn't broken. So things like Andy Griffith, MASH, Harry Mason, Bonanza, Gunsmoke, they stay right where they are because they're doing so well.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to leave us a review at Apple Podcasts. We love to hear from listeners. And be sure to tune in next week for another episode of Strictly Business.